Welcome to the Shia in Al Gurari in Tarsus Noso. I wanted to start with a Rashi tonight, thank you. The beginning of the Parsha of Soto, which is Perek Hei, Pasuk Yud Aleph, starts out at length the description of the laws of Soto, the woman who has been accused and found guilty at least of being involved with another man, and the accusation is that she has committed out-and-out adultery. So in Pasuk Yud Beis, which starts off, Dabro b'nei Yisrael, speak to the children of Israel, and Elisha Aleihem, and say to them, Ish, Ish, ki tista ishta umar lo b'mal, when every man, or any man, when his wife goes off in a wayward direction, soto means to be soto in a derech, to veer from the proper path, and she betrays, umar lo b'mal, she betrays the narrow relationship which she has, and the pasuk goes on to tell what the halachas are concerning such a woman. So Rashi comments over here as follows: Not kosuv l'malam in o'inyam. What do we find described in the Chumash right before the Torah introduces the laws of Sota? It says v'ish es kadoshav lo yihiyu. Each person has an obligation to give the appropriate matnas kahuna, the appropriate portions of his produce to the kohanim. Right, that was the pasuk that immediately preceded the description of the laws of Sota. What's the connection? Right, Rashi, Atam Akiv Matnas HaKohen. If you refrain from giving the Kohen his due, from giving him the Matanos, the gifts which are owed to him, Chayecha, by your life, Tzitzarech Lavo Elav Lahavi Loes HaSota. Right, what's going to happen is you want to avoid having to have dealings with the Kohen. You don't want to bring him your matanos, your gifts. One way or another, you're going to end up having to have business, quote unquote, with the Kohen. The business is going to be you're going to end up going to the Kohen to bring him your wayward wife. So, lesson being, better bring him the tomatoes, rather than have to bring him the sota. Rashi, the Maral has two comments on this Rashi. The first is the rather technical one. So the Gurari writes that Nira, the Lalomad Rashi Mishnichus HaKashios. It's interesting. Rashi does not use a language which we find in Rashi's elsewhere. Lama Nishnicha Parshas Magnus Kahuna L'Parshas Sota. Why does the Torah juxtapose the laws of giving the Magnus Kahuna, the appropriate gifts to the Kohen, with the laws of the Sota? He doesn't use that lashon smichus parshios of juxtaposition. He just says maksiv lamala. What does it say right before the Torah introduces the laws of Sota? They might be inclined to say, okay, it's just another way of saying the same idea. But the Maral says that Rashi is being very, very careful with his lashon. The imis smichus parshios. If the issue over here was the juxtaposition per se, hayel alomai b'lashon hazem lama mismicha parshios Sota l'parshios lamala. Just a little bit later on, in the next parak, Rashi famously is going to ask the question why the parasha of Sota is juxtaposed with the parasha of Nazir. And there, Rashi does use the language, Lama Nismacha parasha of Sota, the parasha of Nazir. Why are the two parashios juxtaposed? So the fact that Rashi doesn't use that language just a parak earlier, says the Maral, is striking. The Og, Menale Shushalok Yisayder, Ashi Isha Lama Nismacha. Furthermore, if the issue is one of juxtaposition, you can only ask the question why two things are juxtaposed with one another if you would think that they shouldn't be juxtaposed with one another. It could be that the simple reason as to why Parsha A and Parsha B are juxtaposed with one another is because that's simply the order in which they were taught to Moshe Rabbeinu, or taught by Moshe Rabbeinu to the people. Why were these two Parshios put together in this order? Well, because that's the order they were in. Right? In other words, it's not necessarily significant that they're in this order unless there's a strong reason that they should be in a different order. Ella, rather, explains to Maral what's prompting Rashi to make this comment is the following. So, lo hoyo lahaskel hakasha v'ish rak v'isha. How does the parsha of Sota begin? Ish, ish, kisista, ishto. Any man whose wife goes astray dot, 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 this is what you should do. You know, in truth, says the Maharal, the man is not really the major player over here. The major player in the parasha of Sota is the Sota herself, the woman. So the parasha really should have said, "V'havel l'michtov, ki sista eishas ish." Right? In other words, the opening sentence, the subject of the opening sentence, should have been the woman. Right? Eishas ish ki sista. When the wife of a man goes astray, isha ki sista. You know, when a woman goes astray, something along those lines. Ish, ish, his sister is so. Any man who finds himself in the following situation is an odd way of presenting the whole scenario, says the Maharal. My ish, ish, his sister is so. El Adwa El Kai. Right? So the fact that it starts off with the word ish is supposed to link it to the previous pasuk. The ish, as Kadosh of Lo Yiyu, Ish, Asher Yitzhak Lakar and Lo Yiyah. There twice in the pasuk which ends off the previous parasha, the word Ish was used in exhorting every person to give his matanos to the Kohen. So, you know, the repetition of Ish over here, the beginning of the parasha of Sota, is meant to be reminiscent of that previous parasha. It's not the Smichus HaParshios per se, it's not the juxtaposition per se, but it's the juxtaposition plus the way in which the laws of Sota are presented, with the focus on the man rather than on the woman, at least initially. So, you know, that's meant to say, you know, mister, you know, in part, what's going on over here is your fault, because had you been more scrupulous about going to the calling, when you were supposed to go to the calling, you wouldn't find yourself in this situation, where now you're being dragged to the calling because of this unfortunate turn of circumstance. That is just an interesting introductory comments that the Maharal has over here in terms of helping us understand you know, what exactly Rashi is saying. And again, it sensitizes us to the fact that, you know, the way Rashi expresses a question, you know, could be very, very significant as well. I think our natural inclination with Rashi would just be to say, yes, the juxtaposition of the parashios. But the Maharal was pointing out that if that was the case, Rashi really should have expressed that idea, you know, a little bit differently.
If, because of the husband, being something bad or inappropriate or taking advantage of the Kohen,
yes,
shouldn't he be the one high-sucking himself instead of being dumped on his wife? And
right.
The consequences that happen,
right, right.
The wife is worse than that happens to the husband.
Right, so again, I think we should hasten to point out over here as follows. You know, when Rashi says that the man is, you know, somewhat to blame over here because he didn't bring his matanos to the Kohen, I don't think for a moment Rashi is implying, and the woman is this poor innocent victim who's caught up in this web, you know, that was spun by her husband. Remember, to become a Sota, the woman has to be warned not to be with a particular man, and she has to have been witnessed that secluded herself with this man. So, you know, it's not an idle accusation. It's not, you know, that the husband is just, you know, throwing things at this poor innocent woman. She's quite guilty of doing something. She may not be guilty of adultery, but she's certainly guilty of something very inappropriate, right? But I think Rashi's just addressing, you know, if the man asks himself, look, I know my wife messed up in this terrible way, so she kind of deserves everything, but what did poor me do to deserve all of this? So to that, Rashi comes and says, you know, don't think you're innocent either, right? But again, it's hard to say that the primary guilt over here is being placed on the husband, because after all, you know, it's not. I mean, she's the one who acted in a way which is clearly inappropriate, even if she didn't necessarily commit an act which was adulterous.
And would that mean if he would have given his mas and chumah, it would never have happened?
Oh, So let's see the next comments in the Gur Aryeh, because again, your question is a great one. You know, so is Rashi telling us, you know, if you just give your trumos to the Kohen, your matanos to the Kohen, you know, right, make sure you'll have shalom bayis, you know, yeah, is it really that simple? Let's see the next Maharal, and then I think we'll be in a better position to answer that question. So, again, as to the meat and potatoes of Rashi's comment, that because the man didn't give his matnas kahuna properly, that's why he ends up having to stand in front of the kohen, you know, bringing his wife to him as a sota. Writes the Maral, the nearer li, the lav after sota. Who I didn't she had sarach la kohen, she has zav on the sora, shekulam srichim la kohanim. The imlokein, maishna sota. Says the Maral, at least initially, it would seem to me that Rashi is not saying that your failure to give matnas kahuna will necessarily mean that your wife is going to end up being a sota. What it means more generally is that the failure to give matnas kahuna means you will be placed in some position where you need the kohen to help you out in a time of distress. So, for instance, the obvious example is the mitzvah. And if someone who's stricken with faras needs the kohen first to paskin on the nega, and then to paskin ultimately that the nega, that the faras, you know, has dissipated, right? So, in other words, you need the kohen for that. In the case of the zav as well, if someone has a certain type of bodily emission, so he needs to bring the karbanos and to have the kohen help him out to be purified. You know, to bring the karbanos and help him be purified from his state of being himself. Because otherwise, there's the Maral, you can ask the question, you know, the point is not so much that your wife will become a sota, the point is that that you thought you didn't need the kohen, so the Ribbono Shel Olam will show to you, you certainly need the kohen. Right? And he goes on to explain as follows. When you really understand this idea properly, you really appreciate the tit for tat, you know, punishment which is being involved over here. Why doesn't the guy want to give his matanos, the gifts, to the kohen? Right, the guy says, why should I give my hard-earned money to the kohen? What did he ever do for me? Right, you know, I earned these tomatoes all myself. Why should I have to go and, you know, give something to the kohen? Lefika omar hakosuf hayecho shetitzarech lo shetayda ma'alas hakohen. So therefore, says the Torah, you know, if you're reluctant to give matanos to the kohen, why? Because in the back of your mind, you're thinking, what does the kohen do for me? Why do I need this kohen? Why do I need to sacrifice a portion of my hard-earned produce to this guy, right? So comes the Torah and says, you'll learn the hard way why a kohen is necessary. Why? Shat kohen hu ha'emsoi. The Kohen is the agent who brings about peace between us, the Jewish people, and the Ribbono Shel Olam by virtue of his bringing the Karbanos. He Yisrael Mikroim Isha LaKadosh Baruch Hu. Kedeksivim Lo Seidi Lo Hayofa Banashim Uvaharbein Mekomos Mikroim Isha. We find both in Tanakh and in Chazal that the relationship between us and the Ribbono Shel Olam is compared to that of a husband to a wife, right? He quotes one example, you know, from Shir HaShirim, right, where the Jewish people is referred to as the most beautiful among women. But the truth is, as the Maral himself says, you could bring countless examples to this idea. I mean, we just read Pashas Bamidbar this last Shabbos, and the Haftarah we read from Hosea, right, where in Hosea, and the whole opening of Hosea essentially compares the relationship between God and the Jewish people to a relationship between a husband and wife. Like the famous Sukkim, Erastikli Lo'olo, Erastikli Betzedek of a Mishpat, Uvechesed of Erachamim, I will betroth you to me, you know, forever. That's all, you know, using the metaphor of husband and wife to describe the relationship between us and Hashem. L'sika, Sarich Lakoi, Lahomi Elov HaSoto, she asked the Gam came Shalom they know Uvein Ishto. She he sota haderech meito. Bakoing osa shalom they nehem. So therefore, says the Maral, there's like a double level of midah keneged midah, tit for tat, which is going on over here. On the most basic of levels, you know, you say you don't need the kohen, but the Rebbeinu Shlomo will show you you very much need the kohen, right? In other words, you know, you think you don't need the kohen, you know, I don't have to take care of him when times are good. Okay, the Rebbeinu Shlomo will show you you need the kohen when times are bad. So from that perspective, again, just filling in a little bit what the Maharal leaves unsaid, but I think it's implicit. You know, from that perspective, it doesn't have to be necessarily that your failure to give matnas kahuna will result in your coming in front of the kohen for the purposes of sota, right? Maybe you'll get dragged to the kohen for the purposes of his dealing with your tzaras, or maybe you'll get dragged to the kohen for the purposes of, you know, because you're a zav and you need the kohen to bring the karbanot in order to rectify that state of affairs, to be mitahir you, you know, in the fullest sense of the term. Okay, right? So from that perspective, there's nothing unique about sota. But on a distant level, on a deeper level, the whole story and episode of the sota is representative of the Jewish people and the Ribbono Shel Olam. We are compared, our relationship with God is compared to that of a husband with a wife. The Kohen in general, the Kohanim in general, keep that relationship that we have with God from going sour. How does he keep that relationship from going sour? He brings the Karbanos. The Karbanos are the fuel that keep the Shalom Bayis between us and the Ribbono Shel Olam, as it were, intact. So you don't recognize the role of the Kohen, the importance of the Kohen in maintaining Shalom Bayis between us and the Ribbono Shel Olam. So you know what your obvious punishment is? You'll see a lack of Shalom Bayis in your own home. And it's going to have to be the Kohen who's going to restore the Shalom Bayis in your own home, much the same way that the Kohen and the Kohanim in general are perpetually restoring the Shalom Bayis between us and Avinu Shabbat Shalom and the Ribbono Shel Olam in heaven.
Did the same scenario happen if someone didn't want to do a Kiddush HaEim, or is it just Dr. Masa and Shreem?
No, I think all matnas kahuna. In other words, he doesn't want to do Kiddush HaEim, you know, he doesn't want to give Chazei V'Shok, I mean, whatever else he doesn't want to give to the Kohen, you know, this is going to be the result. The Zebid Vadai Zomel Gamri Nashah Kohen also shown that he saw Avinu Shabbat Shemayim Nashah Shina Ba'aretz. Right, the episode of the sota really is the earthly parallel to the Kohen making peace between us and the Ribbono Shel Olam through the Karbanos and bringing the Shechina down to the world. K'mo Shepirish Rashi b'Parshas Maaseh, as Rashi writes in Parshas Maaseh, here Rashi writes, HaKohen Mashra Shechina b'Yisrael, it's the Kohen who brings the Shechina down to the Jewish people. Just read it inside for a moment. Lamed Hey, Lamed Hey. As here the Pasuk writes that Lo Shetame Yisra'aretz Asher Atem Yoshvim V'Asher Ani Shochem B'Soch Ki Ani Hashem Shochem B'Soch Tere Yisrael, that the Ribbono Shel Olam causes that the HaKadosh Baruch Hu dwells within the midst of Klal Yisrael, and there Rashi writes Atis Rashi and Tneim Shechina B'Neim, the Shechina is the midst of even in our Tzomo. Sorry, that's Lamed Hei Chofei, I'm sorry. Right, Rashi there asks, why is it that the person who's a Roseach B'Shogig, who kills accidentally, has to stay in the Ir Mikla until the Kohen Gadol dies? So there Rashi writes, Shehu Bo La'ashu Shechina B'Yisrael, the Kohen Gadol causes the Shechina to dwell in the Jewish people, right? So, a Roseach Bo L'Salakit HaShechina B'Yisrael, the Roseach, the murderer, you know, is the one who's pushing the Shechina out of Klal Yisrael, right? So, you know, and the Kohen Gadol, whose whole role is to bring the Shechina to Klal Yisrael, it's not appropriate that the Roseach should be up and about you know, as long as the Kohen Gadol is alive and still serving in that function. Al-Kopanim. So, you know, Rashi writes over here that the Kohen Gadol, and by extension, the Maharal is saying all of the Kohanim, bring the Shechina into Klal Yisrael. Hashem Yisrael Shnikra Ishu, Ba'al Yisrael, who had swung? Right, that, you know, it's the Kohen through the Karbanos causes HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the quote-unquote husband of the Jewish people, to be with us. So who ain't a Rosal Hakir Malas HaKohen? So one who doesn't give Matnas Kahuna doesn't want to recognize the special role of the Kohen in bringing the Shin into Klal Yisrael. So it's appropriate, therefore, that, you know, he's going to end up having to bring his wife as a sota before the Kohen. Not only does he recognize in that way the role that the Kohen plays in Klal Yisrael in general, but he appreciates even more so that the Kohen is the one who brings Shalom Bayis between us and the Ribon Shalom and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know, the Kohen can do that on a micro level between myself and my wife, you know, the person and his wife who's a Sota. The Kohen also does that on a daily level, on a macro level, you know, creating the sense of Shalom between us and Avinu Shebang Shamayim.
But I can ask a question too quick. Does, in fact, the Kohen bring Shalom between husband and wife if she's guilty and she dies? So there's not Shalom between husband and wife. So, on one hand, But the husband is sort of punished there because something bad. Conversely, if the wife is not guilty, then in fact Shalom does take place, but the husband isn't really punished for not having brought Manas Kahuna. He's rewarded because
Right. So let's talk about it's really two different questions, related questions. Let's try to talk about both of them. So first of all, why would the episode of Sota be described as being Shalom between husband and wife? Yeah, that's one possible result, but the other possible result, it's not Shalom Bayis, it's kind of Shalom. You know, the woman is very much gone, you know, after that episode. So first of all, that terminology of Sota being a vehicle for Shalom Bayis is the terminology that Chazal themselves use. Chazal have the terminology where they talk about, you know, the importance or the significance of erasing Hashem's name if necessary to bring Shalom between husband and wife, right? In other words, we take the Megillah that has Hashem's name on it, the Megillah Sota, and we blot it out in the water, and Hashem's name itself is dissolved, you know, is erased in the course of that process. Ordinarily, of course, erasing Hashem's name is a terrible issa, but, you know, says the Gemara, Lasso Shalom ben Ish l'Ishto, in order to make peace between a husband and wife, it's worthwhile, to obliterate even Hashem's name, notwithstanding the fact that that's a terrible avera. So first of all, again, that doesn't explain it, but at least it documents it. You see the Chazal themselves speak about the procedure of Sota as a procedure of Shalom Bayis. So what do they mean by that? So Lechara is Shalom Bayis either way, meaning if indeed the woman is innocent, it restores the husband and wife to one another and removes the cloud of suspicion from the woman. So that's certainly Shalom Bayis. If she's guilty, the truth is, we don't want them to get back together, right? In other words, you know, let's say in a day and age like today, where we don't have, you know, the whole procedure of Sota, if we know that a woman has committed adultery, she's no longer allowed to be with her husband, right? And we would break up the marriage if she had committed adultery, and violated her sacred trust with her husband. So in that case, Shalom Bayis means dissolving the marriage. In other words, you know, the marriage is not palatable at that point. So, you know, it's a little bit more dramatic with the Sota, but that really is Shalom Bayis. You know, it's a resolution to a question which is left, sort of hanging there. The greatness of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as the Navi Hosea says in the Haftarah, which we read today, Shabbos, is that even when we haven't been faithful, nonetheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in his mercy, takes us back and doesn't allow us to be like the Sota, but that's really unique to our relationship with Hashem, in a human context that wouldn't exist. So that's in terms of that. In terms of the question, you know, doesn't the husband kind of get off scot-free if it turns out that his wife is innocent, meaning here he's being punished for not giving his matzanos to the Kohen. What's his punishment? His wife goes home, she and, you know, they have another child. I don't know. Doesn't sound so bad, right? So, two things. So, first of all, yeah, there's a happy ending to the story, but there's a lot of drama till you get there. I mean, certainly no husband, presumably, would willingly want to go through that experience of having his wife be a sota and going through this. Again, it's not quite as traumatic for, you know, for him as it is for her, but it's a traumatic experience nonetheless. Secondly, I would say that, you know, what Rashi is bringing out over here is not so much that there's a punishment, you know, in terms of his, he didn't give matnas kahuna, so therefore your wife is going to be a sota. The way the Maral especially is explaining it, it's more of a learning experience. You know, you question the role of the Kohen in creating shalom between the Jewish people and the Ribono Shel Olam, so you will learn through this experience, you know, why the Kohen is so important and how the Kohen brings shalom not only between us and God, but even between a man and his wife on a simple level. The hope is that, you know, whether or not the man has lasting scars after this experience, hopefully he'll certainly have learned the lesson, you know, that he'll take away from this whole experience, you know, with his wife being labeled as a sota. Okay, that's what we'll pick up following Ma'ariv with another idea from the Maral. Okay, welcome to the second part of the Shir Maral Guri Aryeh in Parshas Naso. So towards the end of the Parsha, we have the Chanukah Mishkan, the dedication of the Mishkan on the various Karbanos, or not really varied Karbanos, the exactly same Karbanos which are brought by the Nesi'im, the princes of the tribes, for the first 12 days of the month of Nisan. So, in introducing Nachshav ben Aminadav, right, the Nasi of Yehuda, and bringing his karbon, the pasuk says, "Tarek Zayin pasuk Yedeis, Ayya Makrin Bayom Arishon as Karbono." The one who offered up on the first day his karbon was Nachshav ben Aminadav, the Master Yehuda, Nachshav ben Aminadav from the tribe of Yehuda. Comments Rashi. L'mati Yehuda, Yichaso Akosav Al Shivso, V'lo Shigav Am Yishivso V'Hikrit. Right? In other words, what does it mean that he was Nachshav ben Aminadav from the tribe of Yehuda? Did he bring his own personal karbon? Or does it mean that he was a representative of Yehuda, and therefore he took the money, you know, from the members of the Shevet, the members of the tribe, and then brought, you know, what was essentially a karbon which had been paid for by members of the tribe? So Rashi says, when it says that he was from Matthew Yehuda, it indicates just that that's where he was from, you know, but the karbon itself was a private karbon. It was not collected from the members of Shevet Yehuda. Eino Omer L'Matthew Yehuda El Shagav M'Shivso V'Hevi. Might you think that it means that he collected money from the members of the tribe? Tamulomar Zeh Karbon Nachshon Mishalo Hevi. Right? So it, therefore, when, after describing the karbon, it says, Zeh Karbon Nachshon Ben Aminadov. This is the sacrifice of Nachshon Ben Aminadov, implying that it was owned, not only brought by him, but it was owned by him as well. It was his own private money, which he invested in bringing the karbon, and that's true of all of the Nesi'im, that it was owned their own private funds, which they used in order to purchase these karbanos. So, after discussing this Rashi a little bit on a technical level, the Maral raises the following issue. The Im Toma, Lomali L'michtov L'matze Yehuda, Havri L'michtov Ayya Makriv Harishon Nachshon Nesi Yehuda. The truth is, in light of Rashi's comment, that the money was not raised from the Shevet, the money belonged to Nachshon himself, the way the pasuk phrases it is a little bit misleading. The pasuk says, you know, there was Nachshav ben Aminadav l'matzei Yehuda, which could be understood as meaning Nachshav ben Aminadav was bringing, you know, the money, the karbon, the funds of which were paid for by the matzei Yehuda, by the Shevet. Why does it say simply, "Vayeh Makriv Bayom Arishon es Karbono Nachshav ben Aminadav Nesi Yehuda"? Right? He was the prince of the tribe of Yehuda, just for identification purposes. Why, you know, mention that it was, you know, this phrase L'matzei Yehuda altogether? And then you wouldn't have to have the phrase at the end of the paragraph, Zekar ben Nachshon ben Aminadav. Wouldn't that be simpler? Yes, the Maral. the Eiron Lomar, so the answer would seem to be, says the Maral, it's coming to tell us an idea, an important idea. Why was it that Nachshon ben Aminadav was the first to bring his karbon? Not because of any personal qualities which he possessed that put him above all the rest of the Nesiim. The Mitzad Asma b'vaday hakol shavim, right? Kol haNesiim, right? It stands to reason, of course, that all of the Nesiim were on the same level, on a personal level, right? In other words, that they were all of equal stature when we look at them, you know, on the personal level. It stands to reason for sure that that was the case. That's the Maharal. We'll come back to that statement in a moment. The only reason Nachshon ben Aminadav was put first in the line was because he was the Nasi of Yehuda. Right? Lamata Yehuda, it was his tribe that pushed him to the front of the line. There was nothing about Nachshon himself that made him, you know, distinguished. That's why it uses the phraseology that it does. That he came first, he was the first one, Lamata Yehuda, because it was Lamata Yehuda, his being from that Shevet, that put him first in the line. The who tafel, Eitzel HaShevet, well, HaShevet tafel Eitzlo. He is subservient to the tribe, not that the tribe is subservient to him. And here the Maral addresses the question, which one notices going through the Psukim. Nachshon is never referred to as Nasi Yehuda. Right? He's never referred to as the prince of the tribe of Yehuda. All of the other Nasiim are described as the Nasi of their respective tribes. Nasi Yisachar, right? We find from the Saud and Suar. Then, you know, the formula which he uses thereafter is Nafi was Nezvulun, Nafi was Neruven. We never find that Nachshon ben Aminadav is referred to as Nafi, as the prince of his tribe, even though obviously he was. That's deliberate, says the Maral, because Nafi was Ne Yehuda would imply that somehow he was in an elevated position because of who he was. But Lamata Yehuda, he was from the tribe of Yehuda, implies that he was just a representative of the tribe, albeit, you know, the highest ranking representative of the tribe, and it was the tribe of Yehuda that deserved to be placed first, nothing unique about Nachshon himself. Once we learned that, by the way, I think you have to add on to the Maral. So once we learned that each Nasi goes in the order in which they do, not because of any personal qualifications, but because the Shvatim are supposed to be organized in a certain way. So thereafter, after Nachshon is introduced, so then we can use the term Nasi in describing each of the other princes. But in other words, you know, with the first Nasi, it's important to stress that it's not because he's the Nasi, it's not because of any particular qualities that he has, it's the Matzah Yehuda, the Shevet Yehuda that deserves to go first, and Nachshon only goes as a representative.
It's from the same logic that you're going to use the term of Matzah. Because when we use the argument, you can't say the Nasi Yehuda because people get the impression it's because of the fact, because of who he was that great, and therefore he went first. Then the people get the same mistake that the person who was the Nasi of a different Shevet, the reason why he was Matzah is not that he represented the Shevet who came in the 2 and 4, but he was just the greatest number 2 in the whole society.
Yeah, but I guess once you made the point with the number 1, you know, it kind of flows logically to the number 2, the number 3, the number 4. That's how I understand it, because otherwise you're left with the Kasha of the Maral. Okay, very nice. So it doesn't say Nasi by Yehuda, but it does say Nasi by all the other, everybody else, right? I think you have to say something like that. It's a very striking idea in the Maral, because the truth is, of all the Nasiim, Kasha ben Aminadav is somebody we actually know a little bit about, from a little bit from Chumash, but certainly from Midrashim. I mean, Nachshon ben Aminadav is a hero. He's the one who jumps into the Yam Suf, causes it to split. You know, if it was just some random name, okay, so he was just a representative of the Shevet, but I don't know, sounds like Nachshon ben Aminadav is a pretty chashuv person in his own right. So I think the point of the Maral, again, clearly Maral knew these Midrashim, the point of the Maral, I think, is not to downgrade Nachshon ben Aminadav, but to tell us that all of the other 11 Nesiim were of equal caliber. In other words, we happen to know that Nachshon ben Aminadav, because it happens to be that he jumped into the Yamsuf first. But you should know, Nisano ben Sur from Yisachar could have done the same thing, might have done the same thing, just that Nachshon was a little bit quicker, you know, at Yamsuf to jump in. But, you know, you shouldn't think that any of these other 11 Nisim are inferior in any way whatsoever in terms of their personal qualifications. A fascinating idea from the Maharal, but certainly I wouldn't have thought of on my own. I would have assumed that, you know, Nachshon ben Aminadab has, you know, personal qualities that put him, you know, above the rest. But the Maharal is clearly saying not like that. He's saying that Nachshon ben Aminadab, you know, and Nisano ben Sur are, you know, are two people who are exactly the same in terms of their personal qualifications. Rav Hartman in his notes references the drush of the Maharal to Shabbos HaGadol, where the Maharal elaborates on this point even more, the shivyon, the equality between the different Nesiyim. And he says, Ikar HaShalom Hayubi Yisrael Ayidei HaNesiyim. Right? The Shalom, the peace that rested in Klal Yisrael came in through the fact that the Nesiyim were 12 individuals who were all on equal footing with one another. And he goes on to say, in a sense, they formed a kind of a circle. In other words, no one was superior to anyone else. And that sense that there wasn't this hierarchy within the Nesiyim themselves brought about a tremendous sense of shalom in the Jewish people. And he quotes something very fascinating. Hashir Shamati, this is all from the Maharal and his drasha, the Shabbos HaGadol. Hashir Shamati the Kabbalah Meirabosai. I have a tradition for my rebellion, says the Maharal. Right before the parsha of the Nesiyim, we have the Birkas Kohanim. The Birkas Kohanim ends up with the word Shalom. Yosem Lecha Shalom. You have peace. What's the juxtaposition? So says the Maharal, I have a tradition from my Rebbeim that the blessing of peace of the Birkas Kohanim was fulfilled through the Nesiyim. The fact that the Nesiyim were all equal to one another and all had the sense of a collegial, you know, relationship with one another. In other words, apparently they all had a sense of mutual respect. That brought the Shalom into Klal Yisrael. And he writes, interestingly, the Shalmati, I've heard, Kizek Kasha al Anoagin Ki Echad Mir Aroshin Shehim Horosh Varishin Kominoso Primus Kloma Shehu Yoser Ika. In running society as well, says the Maharal, society is supposed to be run by a group of equals, you know, a group of senators, a group of ministers. To take one of those senators and ministers and make them the head, make him the primus, make him the prime minister, is not appropriate, says the Maharal. Who min zar, it's a foreign custom, it's not a Jewish custom. The minute you have, you know, one person who's first among equals, already you create a hierarchy and there's difficulty with that. Says the Maharal, the way to do it is to have perhaps multiple leaders. You can't have no leadership. I mean, if everybody has, you know, it's a total democracy, you know, where everybody, you know, has exactly the same say, it's not functional to society, but there should be, it sounds like you say, there should be a council, you know, of leaders. And every member of that council should have an equal vote. You know, the notion that there should be one, you know, president or prime minister or something of that nature, you know, goes against this idea of leadership that the Nesiyim have.
I mean, it sounds like Korach, or
Again, just to amplify that point a little bit, I mean, the Nesiyim are not the ultimate governing body of the Jewish people. The Nesiyim are under Moshe Rabbeinu, right? But he is your Melech. I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu is really the Melech over Klal Yisrael, at least according to some interpretations of that pasuk, right? So I think what he's saying is that there is this notion of somebody at the top, you know, be it a Melech or some other such individual. But to the extent to which there's a governing body, within the governing body, everybody should have an equal vote. Right? And perhaps he's referencing
a system of government where, you know, there was a governing body, but, you know, certain members of that governing body were given more weight, you know, than other members. I'm not sure the primus that he's speaking about, I'm not sure exactly how that worked. But maybe, you know, the prime minister got 2 votes or, you know, something of that nature, or, you know, had more say in terms of the way things went. If you're going to have something like, you know, a parliament, I assume it's something like that he's referring to, it should be like the Nicene, where everybody is considered to be on equal footing, and nobody should be considered more prominent than anyone else. I'm not sure if he would object necessarily to the Speaker of the House notion, because, again, it's good to have, you know, one individual who's designated as being the head just to keep things running properly. But again, the Speaker of the House doesn't, you know, necessarily carry more weight within the chamber. You know, his vote is, you know, equal to anybody else's vote. You know, so, again, I think that still might fall into line with this insight that we see from the Nicene, that any governing body, you know, should treat its various members equally, and that's the recipe ultimately to having Shalom, even if there is going to be a melech on top of them. But the governing body itself, you know, within the governing body, there should be a sense of equality between the various members. Okay. Next week, I think, is regular. I think it's regular. Yeah, pretty sure it's regular. Okay, so there's a session we'll pick up next week. And I wish everybody a wonderful Shabbos.